We've got episode 35 of World War Civ, and
more in, cheerful stuff.
In keeping with the upbeat and optimistic tone of previous episodes on this channel, you had called this episode "Agony and Slaughter," Dave.
Could be called either one.
And it's we're updating the front on 1916, all the fronts, all the battle fronts of 1916. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the path of the war had a tremendous impact on everything. So I'm relying on Alistair Horn, J.N. Westwood, Alan Clark. This is not the same Clark, Christopher, that I was using for the causes of the war. This guy is more following the course of the war and its significance. And, of course, A.G.P. Taylor.
By the way, Alistair Horn... I have read Alistair Horn. I have not read Alistair Horn on this issue, but I read Alistair Horn's book on Algeria, which remains, I think, one of the best books on Algeria out there. It's called A Savage War of Peace, Algeria, 1954 to 1962. So he's, I look forward to hear his 1916.
Well, Horn says that this year was a turning point in the war. German hopes of outright victory vanished, and Allied hopes of winning without the United States also disappeared. This was the last year that Russia would still be a powerful military force. And there was also a significant shift on the Western Front because Britain had to take over the principal burden. And he says that this was old Europe's last chance to survive. They would have had to negotiate a peace based on the stalemate. But the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, and the Russians all believed that they had to keep fighting. They thought that, you know, anything short of victory would lead to revolution at home. Of course, the Russians are remembering 1905. They were all wrong and ended up committing collective suicide. Total war efforts, which we covered, showed that civilians were just as resolute as the military leaders. The munitions industries were humming. The armies had massive numbers of men, of heavy guns, and of ammunition. Well, except for the Russians, but everybody else was armed to the teeth. Their armies were even bigger than in 1914. General Joffre was made supreme commander of all French forces in December of 1915. Rewarded for failures. He called a conference of Allied commanders at Chantilly to coordinate plans for 1916. And this was new, too, because so far the Entente countries had been allies in name only. There had been no coordination of plans, no exchanges of information. British and French commercial agents were bidding against each other for American weapons. Joffre didn't care about the other fronts. But he did have big plans for the Western Front. He wanted to get the British more heavily committed. So we covered all the British adventures in, you know, at Gallipoli and in Mesopotamia and, you know, and he wants them to concentrate almost exclusively in France. So his plan was a massive offensive, a push on the River Somme, S-O-M-M-E. If you have a map of France, you can find it fairly easily. There would be 40 French and 25 British divisions involved in his attack. And what's interesting is there were absolutely zero strategic reasons for choosing the Somme. But it lay just where the French and British armies connected, where they shared the front. So the whole reason for the Somme is that this is where our armies join up. And he wanted to ensure maximum British participation. Haig would have preferred to attack in Flanders again. But Joffre won him over. So, I mean, several writers have pointed this out. It was a strange choice of target. There's no vital strategic prize. If you break through here, it's not going to lead to anything.
You're well, not maybe that's able... why the Germans would least expect it.
Right.
The other thing is the so 65 divisions. This is hundreds of thousands of men.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. Oh yeah. It's enormous.
The division is huge. What, 10,000, 20,000 division at this time?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, maybe a million. Probably not quite a million, but
close enough. Now, on the German side, Falkenhayn had reached a very different conclusion on his own. If we can't achieve victory militarily, or at least with our armies, then we need to attack in a different fashion. So he advocated unrestricted submarine warfare. Sink everything without warning. Just the fact that we're doing it will scare neutrals away from Britain. So as they are blockading us, we will blockade them. And he calculated that Britain did not have the food or the resources to survive without a constant stream of merchant ships, you know, bringing in food and supplies. Problem was, the Germans didn't have enough U-boats yet. Plus, the political leaders were afraid to offend the United States. But Falkenhayn wrote a memorandum for the Kaiser and explained that the only other way to win the war was to cripple the Allies' main weapon, the French army. So if I can't do the submarine approach, then I will go after the French army. He wanted to lure them into an indefensible position, which he had already picked out, and then bleed them white. These are his own words. So we're going to fight a battle not to gain a position, not to achieve an objective other than killing as many Frenchmen as possible.
Is that a good plan?
If there's a way to do it without killing a lot of Germans, I guess. But it's savage thinking, isn't it?
It's savage thinking, and also it's in the context of total war, where they've raised such vast numbers of people. Maybe trying to win by attrition is not, I don't know. I guess that is what happened in World War II, isn't it?
Attrition works both ways, though, doesn't it?
Sure does.
So he chose Verdun. Verdun is 150 miles east of Paris. It is perched at the tip of a long, very awkward salient. So it's a piece of territory that juts out into the German lines, facing the Germans on three sides. Militarily, the French should have withdrawn, straightened and shortened their line. It would have saved them a lot of troops, and it would have saved them a lot of trouble. But Verdun had a historic significance that the French couldn't wean themselves away from. It's a fortress complex, and had been for hundreds of years. The French military engineer Vauban made it a fortress for Louis XIV. And in 1870, it was the last of the major French fortresses to fall to the Prussians. And in 1914, it was the pivot of the French line. So as the Schlieffen Plan drove them back, they held on to Verdun. Had they lost it, Joffre probably could not have won the Battle of the Marne. So three different episodes where Verdun has this almost religious significance. Falkenhayn knew his history. He calculated that Verdun was a semi-sacred site for the French, and that they would not give it up. They would defend it to the last man. He would threaten Verdun with only 9 divisions of his army. Compare that to the 65 that the French are planning to use on the Somme. But he was going to use his heavy artillery to grind them to pieces. This is a very original, very novel plan, but it seems to fit in with World War I. It's scientific mass murder. And the code name for it was Operation Gericht. I looked it up. It has various meanings, including to appear before the court, to face judgment. But Alan Clark translates it as place of execution.
So this whole thing depends on the French just not being able psychologically to abandon Verdun?
Refusing to surrender Verdun, yeah. So the German Fifth Army, commanded by the Crown Prince, this is the Kaiser's heir, they got the job. By skillful use of railways, at night as well as by day, the Germans assembled over 1,200 guns and mountains of ammunition for an assault that was on a front barely 8 miles wide. Now, 8 miles sounds like a lot, but not when you pack hundreds of thousands of men and thousands of heavy guns in there. More than 500 of these German guns were heavies, including they had 13 of the massive mortars known as Big Berthas. These were 420 millimeter mortars. So that's the diameter of the barrel. You can imagine the size of the shells that they are dropping. And these were the mortars that had shattered the Belgian fortresses. So this is the greatest concentration of artillery ever in history. And by World War I standards, it's awesome. So Verdun was a city of about 15,000 people, most of whom who had left. It was surrounded by steep hills and ridges, so very strong defensive terrain. And the key heights approaching the city had three concentric rings of underground forts. And each fort was superbly sited so that their guns could fire at any enemy who appeared on top of the other forts. Underground forts that can fire at each other if Germans are climbing on top of them. The concrete was 8 feet thick. And some of the forts, like the biggest one, Fort Douaumont, they were equipped with heavy artillery and machine guns firing from retractable steel turrets. These are the modern state-of-the-art fortresses. Outlying blockhouses were linked to the main forts by underground passages so that they could be reinforced from the fort garrison, but they could repel attacks from any direction. And the cellars were shellproof. Now, these forts are 5 to 10 miles out from Verdun. And then beyond them, before no man's land, was a protective network of trenches, redoubts, and barbed wire. So if the Germans are planning to attack here, they're going to have to do a standard break through the enemy's trench line. Then they're going to reach three rings of underground forts before they can get to Verdun. So Verdun had the reputation as the most powerful fortress in the world. And despite that reputation, or who knows, maybe because of that reputation, the defenses had been neglected. The fall of the Belgian forts led Joffre to conclude that forts weren't as great as everybody had thought. So he evacuated many of the garrison troops and even removed many of the guns from these forts. So it's a combination of, well, they'll never attack here, or maybe these forts aren't as great as we think, but we need the troops and the guns elsewhere. So the soldiers on duty at Verdun had become slack. They had spent months in a quiet sector, in quotes, a safe sector. There hadn't been any major offensives here. And it was also one of the rainiest, foggiest parts of France. And that the forward trenches were not as well dug as the German lines opposite them. The German Crown Prince had 72 battalions of elite troops. The French had only 34 battalions in the trenches. And many of these were second-class units. There was one outstanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Émile Drian, who commanded two battalions at the very tip of the salient. And his men gave him the information. He was able to warn the high command that an attack was coming. And he was also able to warn that the defenses of Verdun were in a lamentable state. For reporting this, he got his knuckles wrapped. He was considered impertinent And Joffre paid little or no attention. He was busy planning his Somme offensive. He didn't want any sideshows to interfere with it, so he sent no reinforcements. The German offensive was delayed for 9 days by bad weather, but on February 21st, the bombardment began at dawn and continued for 9 hours. It was unlike anything previously experienced on the Western Front. And the concentration of guns, you never got this on the Eastern Front. Not so many guns in such a small space. The poorly prepared French trenches were obliterated. Many of them vanished, and many of the defenders were buried alive. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Germans moved forward. Not in a human wave attack, they had learned, but they were probing. So small groups of men pushed forward, looking for weak points in the French defense. So if they came under fire, they basically marked those zones. Okay, there are still French guys here fighting. That way, you can bombard them. So the next morning, the brutal bombardment started all over again. That afternoon, the Germans attacked more in earnest, and the French line just buckled. It broke. Drian lost over half his men. He himself was killed, shot in the head. But as the front line was overrun, French resistance began to stiffen and the second line held. On the 23rd, the Germans followed the same pattern, massive bombardment, probing, looking for points that were still resisting, and then more bombardment. The French were in confusion. In addition to, you know, trenches that vanished, telephone lines were cut, messengers weren't able to get through, and whole units were disappearing. On the 24th, a fresh division sent into the line, they broke under the bombardment and ran away. And when the Germans attacked, the whole second line of French defenses fell in a matter of hours. There were some odd things that happened, some of them part of legend now, but interesting revelation, I guess, of, you know, how weak the French defenses were. A small group of the 24th Brandenburg Regiment, led by a lieutenant named Eugen Radke, found a way into an underground tunnel, which they followed. It led them into Fort Douaumont, the strongest fortress of all. And they were astonished. They found it virtually undefended. I mean, they went into empty barrack rooms, followed the underground passageway, and walked into a mess hall with a group of French soldiers having lunch. So they just pointed their weapons and yelled, "Hands up," and captured them all. And a little further on, they did the same and found a room full of officers having their lunch and captured them too. So the entire fort fell because a small group of Germans found their way into a tunnel. So the fall of Douaumont was a national disaster. You can't hide this fact, and you can't, you know, spin it as something else. Joffre finally had to take notice that there was something serious going on at Verdun. And he was also at the same time under considerable pressure in the Chamber of Deputies. The politicians were finding out more and more about his conduct of the war, and their confidence in him was waning rapidly. So Gallieni, we mentioned him before, was now the Minister of War, and he'd received reports that Joffre had ample warning that an attack on Verdun was imminent, and that he knew the defenses were in poor condition. So Joffre's response to these charges was typical. He demanded to know the names of the informants so that they could be punished. Doesn't that sound familiar? Whistleblowers over 100 years ago got the same, same treatment. Aristide Briand went to Joffre's headquarters and had to demand that the general be woken up. No, this was the only time in the war that happened. Joffre's sleep time and naps were apparently sacred. So while they went to get the generalissimo, staff officer tried to explain to Briand that Verdun was unimportant. Now, they said, if they were to give up the salient, they could actually shorten their defensive line and be in a better position. Briand was usually mild-mannered and conciliatory, but in this case, he lost his temper. According to AJP Taylor, he shouted, "You may not think losing Verdun is a defeat, but everyone else will. If you surrender Verdun, you will be cowards. Cowards, and I'll sack the lot of you." Joffre was still half asleep. He didn't say anything. He let his subordinates take the heat. And then he said, "The Prime Minister is right. I agree with him. No retreat at Verdun. We fight to the end."
They've fallen into the trap. Yeah.
Falkenhayn was 100% right. So to take over the threatened sector, Joffre sent General Henri Pétain. I'm not sure if you've heard his name before, but trust me, you will.
Marshal Pétain?
That's the guy. So he was considered an expert in defensive warfare, and his orders were to hold Verdun, whatever the cost. So Pétain promised, "They shall not pass." I don't know if he's if he said it the way Gandalf did, but he certainly held.
There is a kind of Helm's Deepness to this whole situation.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if Tolkien was a scholar of this campaign.
Well, Tolkien fought in World War I.
Well,
lost several of his best friends. Yeah, he knew what it was like. Now, the German attack was already bogging down. Losses had been heavier than Falkenhayn had expected, and many of these were caused by French artillery on the other side of the River Meuse. So the Germans planned to kill all the Frenchmen with artillery, but they failed to reckon with French artillery on the flanks. So they're on the other side of the river. We're not attacking them, but they're firing at us. So the Crown Prince wanted to broaden his attack and attack that other side of the Meuse. From the very beginning, he wanted this. Now, Falkenhayn's plan had been to keep the operation small. It wasn't about capturing Verdun. It was about luring in more French defenders so that we can bombard them. But he's dealing with the Crown Prince, right? The heir to the imperial throne. So now he reluctantly agreed to extend the offensive to both sides of the river. And he released another army corps from his precious reserves. And in this brief lull, Pétain was able to stabilize the front. He established a road link to Verdun, an essential, it's described as an artery, and the only artery. And this road became known as La Voie Sacrée, the sacred route. And in that critical first week of March, 190,000 men marched in. Before the battle was over, 78 French divisions were fed into what Taylor calls the mincing machine. And virtually all of them had to pass down the Voie Sacrée. Apparently, the trucks were bumper to bumper all night long down that road. So the German Crown Prince now launched an all-out attack along the left bank of the Meuse, and he was aiming at a small ridge called the Mort Homme, M-O-R-T hyphen H-O-M-M-E. Now, nobody remembered why it was called this, but I find it really odd syntax. It's Mort is death or dead, and Homme is man, so dead man. But if you were speaking French, you would say homme mort. So this is like reverse, weird name. Sorry, got a little geeky on the syntax. This attack turned into a very bitter, very back and forth seesaw battle that went on for the next 3 months. And the pattern was at the same time very monotonous and very murderous. So hours of heavy bombardment by the German guns just saturating this little area, and then German assault troops advancing. They were no longer facing a trench line. They just, you know, clusters of shell holes. The trenches had been blasted out of existence, and the defenders were, you know, taking cover in the shell holes left behind. French troops were told, well, basically the truth, Their mission was to sacrifice themselves. It was their duty to fall. And in descriptions of the Battle of Verdun, I find one of the most horrifying things is that most of the men killed there never even saw the enemy. The Germans finally captured the Mort-Homme Ridge, only to find that they were now exposed to French artillery on Hill 304, a little further out on the flank. So now they start taking heavy casualties from this artillery, and the Crown Prince decided he had to clear Hill 304. So more German divisions are committed to the battle to capture this new objective, and it took until the month of May to clear the hill. At this point, the Crown Prince wanted to call off the offensive. I mean, he could see the casualty reports. We are losing too many men doing this. And Falkenhayn's enthusiasm was also waning. So the plan was right in the sense that he knew the French would not surrender Verdun.
He knew they could kill a lot of French people. He didn't calculate that it would also kill a lot of Germans.
Well, he wanted to keep it small, but he couldn't. They kept expanding the objectives, and then, of course, you know, bringing more French artillery on the flanks into play. But by this point, Verdun had become a symbol for both sides. The strategic significance had been completely lost. Like, what do you gain by occupying this, you know, shell-torn wasteland? I can't see anything. You're not breaking through beyond. But it had become a matter of honor, you know, who's going to win the Battle of Verdun. Pétain had been terribly affected by the horrors he'd witnessed. Joffre could see it, said he'd been too deeply affected. So Pétain was promoted and removed from his position, and he was replaced by two more more aggressive, more ferocious generals, Robert Nivelle and Charles Mangin. Mangin's nickname was the Butcher. That he got that from his own troops. So I think that tells you all you need to know. There was a poet and dramatist, Georges Duhamel, serving as a French army doctor. He wrote, "One eats, one drinks among the dead. One sleeps in the midst of the dying. One laughs and sings in the company of corpses. You find the dead embedded in the walls of the trenches, heads, legs, and half bodies, just as they had been shoveled out of the way by the picks and shovels of the working parties." Joffre appealed to Haig to move up the date for the Somme offensive. Haig mentioned the 15th of August, and Joffre lost his patience and shouted, "The French army would cease to exist if we did nothing by then." So the British general finally agreed to July 1st. Remember, there's no strategic purpose for an attack on the Somme except to have a massive British and French collaboration. But now there is a purpose. It's to relieve the pressure on Verdun. Well, and of course, to kill as many Germans as possible. The month of June at Verdun was probably the deadliest phase of the battle. The Germans had restricted their attack to a 3-mile front, not 8 anymore. In the fighting, they reached a smaller but key fortress known as Fort Vaux, V-A-U-X. It was defended by Major Sylvain Eugène Reynal and 600 men. The garrison should have been 150, so now they're packing men into the fortresses. But the defense of Fort Vaux was epic. The Germans came in underground with demolition charges and flamethrowers. The French stacked sandbags and blocked the underground passages. When the Germans tried to remove the sandbags, they met machine gun fire from behind another stack of sandbags further back. So they had to fight their way down underground tunnels that were defended at every step. Reynal and his men were cut off, but they held up the entire German advance for a week. There were no supplies for them. They ran out of water and kept fighting. There are stories that French soldiers licked the slime off the walls and drank their own urine. They were almost out of ammunition. They had no more food or medical supplies, but it was thirst that did them in. Renal finally surrendered, and the Crown Prince accepted his surrender in person and presented him with an officer's sword as a sign of respect. So curious little bits of, you know, honor and old-fashioned courtesy in the midst of scientific slaughter.
I don't know if it's a reproduction, but there's a photo online of Commandant Reynal passing the sword, surrendering his sword through to his German counterpart. It looks possibly real.
It might be. It was a big deal. By that time, everybody knew the battle was going on, and Vaux became another symbol.
But the photograph, I mean, the photographs back then involved standing there for minutes, right?
Well, not as long anymore. There's a lot of World War I photography. You'd be surprised. Obviously, not as much action photography, but I've seen some, you know, where dirt is flying from a shell landing not too far away. So, no, the photography had improved significantly. In fact, if you are teaching World War I, there's no excuse not to show your students hundreds of photos. Photos of the trenches, of the soldiers, of the forts, all of it.
Now, Peter Jackson made a World War I in color video documentary kind of thing.
Did he?
Not exactly a documentary, just footage. Collection
of images?
Yeah. Well, video.
Okay. Now, just as Fort Vaux was falling, the Russians launched their own summer offensive under General Brusilov. And that put tremendous pressure on the Austrians and the Germans. Falkenhayn had to transfer troops to the east. So the German offensive is tailing off. It didn't end the fighting at Verdun. On June 23rd, they attacked with a new weapon, a new gas, phosgene. Phosgene affects the lungs, and it's particularly deadly. The Germans were able to advance until their machine guns were now firing into the streets of Verdun. And 2 days after that, the combatants at Verdun could hear the rumble of heavy British guns at the Somme, where that offensive was just beginning. Apparently, the British guns at the Somme were loud enough to be heard in Britain. Whoa. That's kind of staggering. The weird thing is that by the time the Somme offensive began to take the pressure off Verdun, the Battle of Verdun was virtually over. From February to August of 1916, the French had lost 315,000 men at Verdun.
Not all killed, lots of wounded, I guess.
I didn't separate the casualties that way. Okay. But wounded and return to duty is not the majority of your wounded cases, right?
Casualties, yeah.
The Germans had lost 282,000. So Falkenhayn's plan succeeded and failed at the same time. And it wasn't the end of the battle. I mean, the killing at Verdun went on. We'll come back to Verdun. But I have to go to the Somme, which is one of the most famous, most tragic battles of World War I. And you can't help being amazed at the Somme. The losses at Verdun were so crippling for the French that their contribution to the Somme offensive shrank from 40 divisions to 16. And on July 1st, only 5 of those actually attacked. So the Somme, instead of this enormous cooperation, turned into primarily a British operation. Many of the units involved in this offensive were territorials. They were reservists. So, you know, not all your elite troops. One battalion of territorials had only 3 trained officers, including one who was stone deaf another with a broken leg. And the commander of the battalion was a 63-year-old officer who had retired before the Boer War. Boer War was 1899 to 1901. So they called him out of retirement almost 20 years later. And these amateur units had been trained to march on the parade ground, to march in straight lines, to keep 2 to 3 paces between each man. Their commanders didn't trust them to attempt anything more sophisticated, like tactics of infiltration, the way the Germans probed at Verdun. So the British territorials, we don't think they can do that. So we're going to send them across in lines, 2 to 3 paces apart. They've been trained to do that. So the hope was that their enthusiasm and their courage would make up for their lack of expertise. This is a trend that you find returning in British military history, particularly in World War I, but there are lots of other episodes. Okay, the other guys are better trained and they have better weapons, but you guys have courage and, you know, British pluck. So that should equal out. So the only high ground in this area was in German hands. They had an excellent view of British preparations. And the Germans had also had 2 years to dig in here. Unlike the British, they didn't, you know, dig shallow trenches so the men wouldn't get comfortable. The Germans dug, and they had gone as deep as 40 feet underground, where they were safe from British shells. And the irony is, it was the British who really encouraged them or taught them to do so. On many stretches of the front, the French and the Germans had a live and let live philosophy. If you're in a quiet sector, don't cause trouble, right? Don't start shooting at the other guys. They're going to shoot back. So just, you know, keep it civilized. But the British wanted to keep their men in tip-top shape, and they preferred to continually strafe the opposing trenches. So they would, you know, carry out short snap bombardments, hoping to catch the Germans napping. And they also carried out regular trench raids at night. Now, trench raids are useful. You can find out where the enemy strong points are. You can come back with prisoners. But the British did this mainly to keep their own men, quote, on their toes. I'm sure that it's annoying for the enemy to be raided at night, but really it helped the Germans figure out where an attack was imminent because of the increased activity. Right, there's the standard level of British trench raiding, and now it's stepped up to a big degree. I wonder where they're going to attack. So according to basically every writer I consulted, the Germans were abundantly aware that a big push was coming. So they had weeks to rehearse their defenses. So when they bombard us, we're going to be underground in shelters that are untouchable. When the bombardment ends, I mean, it has to end for the British troops to advance, right? The moment the bombardment ends, we're going to rush from our underground shelters to our machine gun posts. So the Germans practiced, and they got their time down to 3 minutes. So essentially, 3 minutes after you finish firing your shells at us and your infantry starts to come across no man's land, you know, we're going to be waiting for you. The British preliminary bombardment lasted 5 days, just to completely eliminate, you know, whatever last element of surprise remained. By British standards, this was an unprecedented weight of shells. But they had less than half as many heavy guns as the French. They had nothing to compare with the French 240 millimeter mortar and the 400 super heavy guns available to General Foch. And to make matters worse, a depressing number of British shells turned out to be duds. They simply didn't explode. And there was defective ammunition purchased from America that went off prematurely. It blew up you know, as you fired it or before you fired it. And this happens so often that some British gun crews called themselves the Suicide Club. So the bombardment was a failure. Yes, it did obliterate sections of the frontline trenches, and they killed some of the small numbers of troops, you know, you leave a skeleton crew there to watch, and they killed a number of these small watching units. But it created a moon landscape, right? A landscape pitted with shell craters that was difficult to cross. And meanwhile, the main body of German troops was safe underground. The British shells were also designed to blow away barbed wire obstacles. And this they did not do. So that failed as well. At dawn on July 1st, the British bombardment ended. And a few minutes later, at 7:20 a.m., the British set off what was called the Hawthorne Ridge Mine. So they had tunneled under the German lines, old-fashioned medieval castle siege technology. You dig under the enemy lines, under the wall of the castle, and you bring in wood there and you build a framework. And then you dig some more until the wall is sagging. And then you set fire to what you've built, and the wall collapses. So in this case, they dug under the German lines, built a huge tunnel, and then filled it with 40,000 pounds of explosives. Now, we were talking about photography a moment earlier. The British filmed the Hawthorne Ridge Mine. You can see film of the explosion. They set it off and basically blew the ridge apart. They had 19 different mines set off that morning, all of which they blew up 8 to 10 minutes before the British soldiers climbed out of their own trenches, before they went over the top, as the expression was. So,
I'm looking at the explosion.
Crazy, right?
It's like a cloud. It doesn't look like a mushroom cloud. It looks more like a tree, like a evergreen tree kind of.
Yeah, massive explosion. So I don't know how much damage they did to the Germans, but the attack came 8 to 10 minutes later. So you couldn't have given the Germans a better warning or more time to recover. So 100,000 British soldiers climbed out of their trenches and advanced into no man's land at a steady walk.
They don't have that training to advance in small groups and
have to have the line. We want you to arrive at the same time, right? Instead of a piecemeal attack, everybody arrives at the same time. So we all travel at the same pace and keep our spacing. The other reason that they didn't run is, according to Horn, the men were carrying between 66 and 90 pounds of equipment on their backs. Their personal kit, their water bottles, rations, 2 gas masks each, their rifle, their bayonet, 220 rounds of ammunition, and their entrenching tools, so that they could, you know, dig in once they had captured enough German territory. Some of them were also carrying hand grenades. Some of them were carrying bombs for the mortars.
So couldn't they advance without that stuff, fight, and then go back for it if they win?
Or have more guys bring that stuff up?
Or go back to it if they lose? I mean,
seems like a lot of stuff to carry. Yes. Yes. You're not going to run with 90 pounds of equipment on your back. So the British came walking across no man's land and in broad daylight. Many of the officers had told their men that after a shelling like that, they were going to meet little or no opposition. In fact, the British officers were more concerned about keeping the line straight and being able to tell where their men were. I could not find the story in Horn, but it is in other sources that some units had basically reflectors attached to the back of their packs so that officers further behind could see how far they had advanced, which meant, of course, that once they turned around to retreat, the Germans could see them too. But we weren't anticipating something like that. Apparently, July 1st was a broiling hot day. The Germans had come out of their shelters within minutes, and they waited. Now, some of their positions had been blown up, but they used shell craters for cover, and they quickly established a firing line. Now they watched the British walk towards them in unbroken lines, and they couldn't believe it. Their reaction was astonishment. What are they doing? Then they saw a second line behind that, and a third, and a fourth. And the only conclusion they could reach was that the British didn't expect to find anyone alive.
This is hard to believe. Was the British commander secretly working for the Germans or something? Like, I can't grasp that this would happen 2 years after the war started, and they know. I guess they're just, it's a faith that they're shelling, like an excessive faith in their shelling.
Well, it's the triumph of wishful thinking over experience that should have been gained. Yeah, they thought that because they had more guns and had fired more shells that the Germans would all oblige them by dying.
Right.
The British soldiers marched forward, and then they found German barbed wire. Now, they found some gaps in the enemy wire. So naturally enough, they went for the gaps, which means that they bunched up there, and that's where they were cut down by very heavy, very accurate machine gun fire. And that was the story across most of the front. So yeah. you were asking on a different occasion how many soldiers are in a battalion. Well, here's two from the Battle of the Somme, the 2nd Middlesex and the 8th Yorks and Lancs. So they're recruited in Yorkshire and Lancashire. So both of these units averaged between 28 and 30 officers and 700 men.
So that's a battalion. Yeah, I've always heard like between 500 and 1,000.
Right. So the 2nd Middlesex lost 22 officers and 601 men. And the 8th Yorks and Lancs lost 21 officers and 576 men. I mean, those are some pretty catastrophic losses. I don't know what you do with those units afterwards other than, you know, send them to the rear and then start planning where you're going to get the replacements. There were some successes in the Battle of the Somme on the British side. So General Congreve's 13th Corps, they were attacking right next to the French, and they captured the headquarters of a German regiment and took 1,900 prisoners. Wow. They also found cellars full of German dead killed by French heavy mortars. At a place called Thiepval, the Ulster Division advanced a mile. I mean, that's a huge gain at this point. But after the disasters of 1915, Haig had ordered that no battalion commanders or second-in-commands should go in the first wave. They had this annoying tendency to get killed, and then there's nobody in charge. So the commanders are back, you know, the division goes forward, advances a mile, and now there's no one senior enough to order up reinforcements. They sent runners back for fresh orders, but none of them ever returned. And by the time they sent, headquarters sent a reserve brigade to join the Ulster men, it also had no senior officers with it. The men advanced too fast. They ran into their own artillery barrage, friendly fire, and lost two-thirds of their men.
So consequences of this leading from the rear philosophy can be rather severe.
I keep encountering poor communications when it comes to the British, plus a very cumbersome chain of command. Haig was at a command post in a French chateau 12 miles behind the line, and he's receiving reports by telephone. And he couldn't figure out why there had been so little progress reported. You know, my master plan is being carried out. How could it possibly go wrong? So he concluded that in some cases, the men must have shirked. You know, they must have balked at advancing. So he sent in the second wave. And in many cases, these units are now sheltering in the forward trenches, and they're watching as what's left of the first wave comes reeling back or staggering back. You know, one writer described them as the shattered remnants of the first wave, you know, a bunch of wounded.
Which Haig has absolutely no idea about because he's so far behind that he doesn't.
Yeah. And then in a case of, you know, either incredible courage or remarkable stubborn stupidity, the second wave went in anyway. And as they're crossing no man's land, they come across, they come upon the masses of corpses of the first wave, many of them hanging on the barbed wire. And, you know, they're going to try to attack through that. Talk about, post-traumatic stress disorder. What does that do to you? And they went in with incredible courage. As I said, the Newfoundland Regiment, Newfoundland was a separate colony then. It was not part of Canada. They attacked at Beaumont-Hamel. And in a matter of minutes, they lost 93% of their men. 780 men went in. 110 survived. Only 68 were present for roll call the next day. There were some British officers observing their advance. And one praised it. He said it was an incredible display of courage under fire. The attack failed, he said, because dead men can advance no further. After the war, the women of Newfoundland collected money to buy the field where so many of their men had died. There's a monument there of a bellowing caribou. Pretty unusual.
So this is the pointless expenditure of lives.
Yeah. It's just feeding men into like hamburger meat into a grinding machine. The French had more successes that day. For one thing, they were on more level ground. For another, they had better guns, including much heavier guns. And the defenses, German defenses there weren't as formidable. Their infantry, better trained, moved more quickly with more flexibility. The Germans were surprised because after Verdun, they didn't think the French were capable of a major offensive. And General Foch cleverly delayed his attack until several hours after the British had gone in. And that gave them surprise against the Germans. The French captured 6,000 prisoners and came close to a breakthrough. General Balfourier asked British General Congreve, who was next to him, to support him, but the British wouldn't budge. And with their flank hanging in the air, the French could not continue to advance. So by the end of the day, German reinforcements were coming up with plenty more machine guns. So yet again, a case of, you know, what success you do achieve, well, now you've inherited a piece of moon landscape that's been chewed up with shell holes and, you know, mud and all of the rest of it. And you can't advance very fast, whereas the defense can bring in reinforcements by rail and set up a new line, you know, within by the end of the day in some cases. So the Battle of the Somme, the first day, is the worst day in British military history. They lost 60,000 men in a single day, 20,000 killed. And according to Horn, most of their casualties were caused by about 100 German machine gun teams. Just to give you some perspective, the British lost more men in a single day than the French did in the worst month at Verdun.
So a machine gun team is what, 5, 10?
Three guys.
Three. So 300 killed 20,000 people.
And wounded 40,000 more. Yeah.
Wow.
So Haig had no idea of the extent of the losses. I mean, nobody's counting, you know, that same day. It wasn't until July 3rd that he was given some idea of the magnitude of the disaster. he ordered the attacks to continue, concentrating on the southern sector where there had been some success. But once again, British guns were short of shells, and it had rained, turning the battlefield, which was, you know, pocked with shell holes and craters, turning the battlefield into a, what did Horn call it? A treacherous, hellish landscape. On July 14th, General Rawlinson, who was, you know, also appalled by the casualties, he decided to try something new, attacking at night. Now, this is pretty risky given the, you know, training of your troops and the landscape that you'd be going into. So the French predicted a disaster. They called his plan an attack organized for amateurs by amateurs. And then, you know, just to help out, Haig postponed the attack by 24 hours, which, you know, what wasn't a help. Rawlinson sent in six brigades, 22,000 men, after a very short bombardment, and they punched out a four-mile-wide gap, 1,000 yards deep, and they even breached the German second line. That's an incredible success compared to, you know, everything else that's gone on. Once again, British communications were bad. The higher commanders were too slow, and it took 9 hours for reserves to be sent in. And by then, the Germans had rallied. You know, they had reinforced the second line, recaptured some of the ground, and set up a third line, so you're not going any further than that. Haig didn't give up. He settled down to a battle of attrition. It continued through August and September. There's a official Australian history of the war, which says that Haig's new technique, and I quote, merely appeared to be that of applying a battering ram 10 or 15 times against the same part of the enemy's battlefront with the intention of penetrating a mile or possibly two. I mean, you can't, you obviously questioned the tactics, but what is the what are we trying to achieve here?
Killing as many of them as we can.
At the cost of as many of ours?
As we can.
One officer wrote, "We have just come out of a place so terrible that a raving lunatic could never imagine the horror." And for, you know, the Battle of Verdun is over. Verdun has been relieved. The last German effort there was on July 11th. So if your goal is to take the pressure off Verdun, that's done in, you know, 10 days after the Somme began, and you carried it on for 3 months. Falkenhayn called off the offensive, ordered all German forces on the Western Front to remain on the defensive. And at the end of August, he was replaced by Hindenburg and Ludendorff. I'll have more to say about the significance the
dynamic,
of that.
The dynamic duo.
Yeah. So Haig kept battering. On September 15th, he decided to use a new experimental weapon, tanks. He had 50 of them.
So this is late 1916.
Yep. Now, Kitchener had rejected tanks as, quote, a pretty mechanical toy, but of limited military value. Which reminds me of what Foch said about airplanes. So they were both pretty wrong. I found out where the name came from. They had been developed in complete secrecy. Somebody wanted to use the word landships to describe them, but it was a little awkward and too close. So they gave it the name tank to throw off the Germans. And when they were shipping them around, they were describing them as, you know, like oil tanks or...
Yeah, water tank. Or,
yeah, sure. Something like that. Very, very interesting history of the origins of tanks. Obviously, they were based on farm tractors so that they could get across the landscape of World War I. But also the broad tracks would let them cross a trench. Rather than having wheels and falling in. So the British had Mark I tanks. These were the descendants of the original prototypes. One was called Big Willy. I'm sure the British laughed at that quite a bit. The name was changed to Mother. And then there was another tank called Little Willy. And the British divided their tanks into male or female, depending on their armament. So one of them had 2 6-pound cannons and 3 Hotchkiss machine guns, and the other had 4 Vickers machine guns and 1 Hotchkiss. Now, these tanks had a crew of 8. It took 4 men to handle the steering and drive gears. And the tanks were capable of, you know, their top speed, 6 kilometers an hour. That's 3.7 miles an hour, which
you can walk.
It matches the speed of marching infantry. So the tanks were supposed to simply keep pace with the infantry. And then the tanks would assist in the destruction of enemy machine gun positions. In practice, though, you know, with the battlefield terrain, the speed of the tanks on broken ground could be as little as 1 mile an hour. So the inventors of the tanks begged Haig not to waste the surprise effect by using them before they were ready. So they said, you know, wait until we have perfected them, because they're very prone to mechanical breakdowns. And second, wait till we have more of them. And let's use them as like a massive surprise rather than a little surprise. And the most important thing was that they'd been designed to cross an ordinary trench line. They could roll over barbed wire, and they could, you know, they could span a short distance. They were not meant for the Somme battlefield or a place like Verdun, like a lunar landscape of mud and shell craters. Like, that's not what we designed them for. So 32 of the 50 tanks reached the assembly point in working order. 24 actually went into battle, and that's where the majority broke down, got stuck, or were knocked out of action. So they were impervious to rifle bullets and machine gun bullets for the most part, but artillery shells could still, you know, blow off a piece of their track or knock them out of action. A grand total of 9 made it across no man's land, and at the village of Flers, 4 of the tanks advanced down the main street with British infantry following. And the Germans had no answer to it.
Yeah.
But once again, poor communications wasted the temporary advantage. So way to go, Haig. You revealed that we have tanks and we got absolutely nothing out of using them. Except confirmation that you should have waited until they were, you know, more perfected. In the fall, the rains turned the battlefield into a slippery bog. Men actually drowned in the mud. If you fell off the paths, you were in serious trouble. Haig kept battering. He seemed to have believed that the enemy were close to breaking. On November 13th, a final attack captured Beaumont-Hamel, which by then was a completely worthless prize. If you look at aerial photographs of some of these battlefields, you can see what used to be a village. Right? There are no buildings left, but the concentration of shell holes and shell craters showed, wow, like they really targeted this particular spot. Oh, I can see the roads leading in, and oh, there's a crossroads there. So people must have lived there. Yeah, not anymore. In the Battle of the Somme, the British took over 420,000 casualties. The French lost 200,000. German losses estimated between 450 and 500,000. If you're interested, General Haig was promoted to field marshal.
Oh my God! And the revolution didn't happen in Britain or France.
No, because they had changed. I think they had brought in the Official Secrets Act, and one of them was staggering the casualty reports. So early on in the war, they published all the casualty reports, and since the units were, you know, territorially organized, if say the Yorkshire guys went in and took a beating, it would be a pretty rough day in some villages in Yorkshire when you saw the casualty lists and, you know, 9
you
of
know,
the.
You know, there's other. I've heard that there's a contemporary conflict where one side is making a. Hiding their casualties and minimizing them.
That's pretty standard, don't you think?
Yeah, I'd say it is. Yeah.
Oh, wait till we get to World War II. Good grief. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Meanwhile, at Verdun, Generals Nivelle and Mangin had recaptured the forts Douaumont and Vaux, and they pushed the Germans almost all the way back to their starting point. And I have to say, Nivelle, Robert Nivelle, this is, launched some effective counterattacks using a new technique. He would have the same heavy bombardment, but then limited objectives for the troops to occupy. He wasn't trying for a breakthrough. We're just going to go forward, occupy the enemy's forward trenches, and then stabilize there.
So more like a constrictor. This is what I gather the Russians are doing now. They're not trying to get a big blitzkrieg and take to the capital. They're just like slowly constricting, right? Like you just advance inch by inch. And
I think part of it too is the morale of your own troops, right? Every time you tell them we're going for a breakthrough, they realize we're all gonna die.
Yeah.
Whereas if you tell them, okay,
synonymous with
suicide, right? So now we're only asking you to go forward 1,000 yards, mm-hmm. and then dig in, and then we'll support you. So casualties were still heavy, but there were some successes. So Verdun was saved. 9 of the neighboring villages had vanished. An estimated 800,000 men on both sides had been killed, wounded, or gone missing.
And over how long of a period of time? How many months?
A few months.
Yeah.
Many of the dead were never found. Verdun is a memorial site today, and I can only recommend a visit. It's really quite staggering. There's an ossuary where they collected the bones of more than 100,000 unidentified and frankly unidentifiable soldiers. The names of the missing Frenchmen are inscribed on the walls. My wife and I walked through there. It was mind-boggling.
Like just the number.
The sheer number. It's absolutely staggering. Well, if you go to there are World War I grave sites all over Belgium and France. So we visited several British ones, a French cemetery, and a German one. So the British use headstones, and the headstones will have a symbol on them to indicate whether these are British troops, Canadian. There's a maple leaf for the Canadians, Australians and so on. The French use white crosses, and the Germans use black iron crosses. You can't believe how many men are buried there, but each place, I mean, now it's all obviously on websites, but back then there were still looked like a little phone booth in the corner of the cemetery, and there would be a book in there listing where everybody was so you could find your relatives. But as we walked along, they have the name of the dead soldier, the unit that he belonged to, and the date that he was killed. A number of them, however, instead of a name of a soldier, would have the inscription "known only unto God."
Wow.
Meaning God knows who this is. We don't. Some of those sites might have a maple leaf. So this is we know this is a Canadian because of the buttons on the uniform or some piece of equipment which was, you know, obviously Canadian. So this is a Canadian guy. We just don't know who it is because we didn't find enough of his body to be able to tell. And, you know, Verdun just multiplied that by 100,000. Falkenhayn wasn't the only general to be replaced. General Joffre was finally sacked and replaced by General Nivelle. And that turned out to be a really, really bad idea.
Despite how bad Joffre was.
Yeah, but Joffre was a kind of a pretend everything is okay guy. Nivelle is an aggressive attacking general, fiery. Right. The politicians fell as well. Asquith was out as prime minister, replaced by Lloyd George. And the French government of Aristide Briand fell in March of 1917. Now, French government's falling is not a surprise, but in wartime? That's a big shakeup. 3/4 of the French army had passed through Verdun, and they had been scarred forever. One junior officer, Raymond Joubert, wrote, "They will not be able to make us do it again another day. That would be to misconstrue the price of our effort."
What does that mean, though? I don't understand.
"You asked us to sacrifice ourselves at Verdun. Don't ask again."
Like, no more pointless battles?
Yeah.
Or something?
Yeah, no more pointless offensives, no more suicide attacks. Joubert was killed at Verdun. And the Germans were right. The French army was no longer capable of a major offensive. When Nivelles tried to launch an offensive in 1917, the French troops mutinied. The only way to get them back into the trench lines was to promise, as you say, no more pointless offensives. Which, you know, it might have been nice to have that distinction earlier on in the war. Like, could you tell us whether this is a pointless one or this actually
Does this mean you know which ones are pointless?
Exactly. Pétain, one of the heroes of 1916, was also scarred for life. In 1940, when World War II was going on, he was a defeatist and was prepared to surrender and collaborate with the Germans rather than fight another war on French soil. AJP Taylor said Verdun was the most senseless episode in a war not distinguished for sense anywhere. Idealism perished on the Somme. The enthusiastic volunteers were enthusiastic no longer. They had lost faith in their cause, in their leaders, in everything except loyalty to their fighting comrades. The war ceased to have a purpose. And I think it's fair to ask, did it ever have one? Yeah. I think these guys just took it for granted that, you know, we're the good guys fighting for a good cause. But after sacrifices like that, you kind of have to ask, what exactly are we fighting for? And of course, the battering on the Western Front just went on for its own sake. It's a contest of endurance now.
This is Taylor?
Yeah.
When he says they'd lost their faith in their cause, leaders, and everything, is he talking about both sides or just France and Britain?
He's really specifically talking about the British, but doesn't it sound like all three armies have been scarred by this?
Yeah, but it does seem, I don't know, I guess we'll keep going, but it does seem like Germany still has a little more.
Well, they've gone on the defensive completely.
Right.
On the West, anyway.
So they're not trying to. They're not anymore trying to.
Well, that's the thing. They now have to face the fact that they're not going to win on the battlefield. Not on the West, anyway. So then what do you do? How do you win a war when you can't win a battle? That's an interesting question, which we'll deal with in a couple of future episodes. Time to go to the east, though. Do you remember the name Brusilov?
One of the commanders.
Russian general on the Southwest Front, one of the few that had some successes in 14 and 15.
And this is because he wasn't fighting the Germans. Or,
well, that's a good point. I'd have to recheck his track record. But he's had successes, and this is the only offensive in World War I that's named after its commander. That's interesting to me, anyway. So the Eastern Front now ran from Riga on the Baltic to the border of Romania. That's over 500 miles. The Russians had divided their line into three fronts. The Northwest Front, commanded by General Kuropatkin. And if the name sounds at all familiar to you, he was in the Russo-Japanese War, where he showed a tendency to poorly timed retreats. The West Front, commanded by General Evert, who seems to have had an allergy to offensive actions. And the Southwest Front, under General Ivanov, another master of timidity. Major General Alexeyev was chief of staff, and he seems to have been fairly capable. since the Tsar, since Nicholas had dismissed his uncle and taken over as commander-in-chief, in name only, it was Alexeyev who was responsible for operations. Unfortunately, he just had terrible generals to work with. And that was partly because while Nicholas was away from Petrograd, from St. Petersburg renamed, right? St. Petersburg sounds too German. So Petrograd means Peter's city in Russian. It was the Empress Alexandra and her favorites, her court favorites, who opposed the appointment of any man with either intelligence or strong character. They wanted yes men and sycophants in key positions, somebody who wasn't going to criticize them.
And couldn't you have like some who have one and some who have the other, but no one who has both? That would work out okay, right?
It's amazing how they blocked the advance of anybody with
careers. The opposite of Napoleon, right? Careers closed to talent.
Yeah. I mean, we're not just talking about Alexandra here. We're talking about her favorite, Grigory Rasputin. So Rasputin had a simple criteria for who gets a promotion. Are they nice to me? So if you suck up to Rasputin, you're in line for a promotion. If you look at him sideways or criticize him, you're going nowhere. Also, the influence of Tolstoy's novel, War and Peace, came to be absolutely enormous. It covers the Napoleonic War, the invasion of Russia by Napoleon, and it celebrates Marshal Kutuzov's deliberate retreat, luring Napoleon deep into Russia where he could be defeated. So Tolstoy was further celebrating this concept of victory through retreat. And unfortunately, there were a lot of Russian generals who thought that's the way to do it, but not an offensive. The winter of 1915-16 was unusually mild. The Russian army slowly recovered. New recruits were trained and deficiencies were made up. The lack of rifles and the shortage of ammunition and even boots, that wasn't repeated. Most frontline units had their full complement of machine guns and field guns. I have to admit, there still weren't enough shells for the heavy artillery. But the Russian army was stronger numerically and in terms of equipment than it had been in 1914. There was one thing that they had lost that they could not replace, and that was trained non-commissioned officers. So too many corporals and sergeants were dead or missing, and they didn't have very good replacements. So a bit like the situation of the British Army, enthusiastic amateurs. The armies were re-equipped thanks to a tremendous effort and at terrible cost. Taylor points out that this could only be achieved by sacrificing everything to feed the army and its 2 million horses. He's one of the few who points this out, the sacrifices that Russia made to equip their army and to continue to feed them. Before the war, Russia's main export was wheat, and the exports were immense, right? Now there were food shortages in Russia. Too many peasant farmers were dragged off to the army. Distribution was inefficient, and the administration of rationing was clumsy at best, and of course completely corrupt at worst. Now Ludendorff, in command on the Eastern Front, had ambitious plans for an offensive that would cut the Russians off in Latvia and possibly open the road to capturing Petrograd or St. Petersburg. Falkenhayn said no, because he had, as we know, he had his plans for Verdun. And when the Austrian commander, Conrad, wanted an offensive against the Italians, Falkenhayn also said no. And he warned him, don't transfer any troops from Galicia to the Italian front. The Italian front's going nowhere. Just leave it and don't weaken Galicia. But You know Conrad by now. He ignored the advice. At the Chantilly conference, which I mentioned before, Joffre and Haig were planning the Somme offensive. They weren't expecting much from the Russians in 1960, not after the beating they took in 15. So their plan, however, was thrown off in February when the Germans attacked Verdun. So once again, they called on the Russians to mount an offensive in the east to draw off German reserves. And the fall of Fort Douaumont, the French panicked, and they called on the Russians as ever. And the Tsar, chivalrous as ever, responded. So in March and April, there was a hastily planned Russian offensive with actually surprising artillery support. The Germans were caught off guard by the intensity of the Russian bombardment. They broke through German front lines in the Battle of Lake Narok, but the ground was poorly chosen, quite unsuitable. It was between two lakes just before spring thaw, and within a few days, the snow melted and the battlefield was a mess, crisscrossed by hundreds of little icy rivulets from swollen rivers and broken reservoirs. You know, if you're going to fire that many artillery shells, you're going to knock off dams and things like that. So in some places, the Russian infantry was advancing waist deep through icy water against machine gun positions. So more incredible, stubborn courage. Ludendorff brought up reinforcements, and for some unknown reason, the Russians withdrew their heavy artillery and their aircraft from that sector. The Russian soldiers were left almost defenseless. They hadn't been able to dig anything better than shallow trenches because of all the swamps. And these guys were without gas masks. Don't ask me why. They suffered heavy casualties due to German barrages and gas attacks, and were driven back to their starting positions in a single day. One day, March 17th, Russian dead, 9,700. German dead, 560. No gain in territory, no strategic advantage, no relief for Verdun. You just squandered lives and mountains of ammunition. Despite this disaster, I mean, maybe they qualified it as a relatively minor disaster in the scale of all the disasters we've experienced and will continue to. Alexeyev was already planning a bigger operation to take the pressure off Verdun. So the first thing he did was replace Ivanov, who was too pessimistic, and replace him with General Alexei Brusilov, who had distinguished himself in 1915. This is on the Southwest Front. So you're right, again, it's facing the Austrians. There was a conference of commanders in April, presided over by the Tsar. Both Evert and Kuropatkin said that they preferred to stay on the defensive, and they both claimed a shortage of heavy artillery and shells. They also said they were expecting a German summer offensive. Brusilov disagreed. He suggested that they attack on all fronts. And his reasoning was this: the Germans had superior railway communications, and they could quickly shift troops to any sector that was threatened. They'd seen it before. But if the Russians attacked at multiple points, the Germans wouldn't know right away which one was going to develop into the main thrust. And Brusilov also knew from prisoners and from spies that the Habsburg army's morale was really quite low. The Czechs in particular were ready to desert. And on top of that, as I said, Conrad lied to Falkenhayn and withdrew 9 of his best divisions from Poland to use against Italy. I'm relying on Alan Clark here. He says that Brusilov was handsome, forceful, and had a reputation for success. However, he was not subtle, and he was not skillful in argument. Had he been a little more devious, he might have suggested a plan that the other generals would have opposed so that he could compromise and move to the option that he really wanted all along. Instead, he put forward his case and was then forced to accept a second best alternative. I think anybody who's ever sat on a committee can relate to this experience, right? It was finally agreed that they would begin an offensive at the end of May. Brusilov would lead off first. Everett would follow suit soon after. Brusilov's attack would be a diversion, and as a sop to Everett's ego, he would have the main thrust. So he would get the larger allocation of men and resources. And Brusilov's one of those guys, a bit like Congreve, better. He had learned from experience, and he had a few new tricks up his sleeve. First of all, instead of concentrating his forces in one location, he asked each of his four army commanders to prepare an attack. So with preparations going on in four locations spread over a 200-mile front, the Austrians would have no idea where the main blow was going to fall. And also, Brusilov had seen that previous attacks failed to achieve surprise. You know, the location wasn't a surprise, neither was the time. So he banished newspaper correspondents, court emissaries, and anybody else that was just hanging around. And he said nothing to the Tsarina or her friends. He suspected her of being a careless talker, which she was. So he put this curtain of secrecy over his operations. The Austro-Hungarian line was strongly fortified. They had three defensive belts a mile or two apart, well-built dugouts, machine gun nests, sniper posts. Each belt had a barbed wire barrier of 20 rows of posts with barbed wire affixed to them. Thick wire, some of it electrified, and some of it mined. Now, Brusilov had aircraft taking good photographs of the defenses. And then he transferred this information to large-scale maps so that his officers knew exactly what they were facing. The artillery took some seemingly random shots, but they were sighting shots. They're getting the range of their targets. But otherwise, they conserved their shells. And then the Russians dug forward trenches to serve as assembly and jumping-off spots. So while Brusilov is preparing, Everett is declaring that he needs more time. But the pressure on Verdun was mounting. The Italians were defeated at Trentino. So the Allies needed help. The Russians had to do something. Brusilov attacked on the 4th of June. Three of his four armies broke through at once. They achieved surprise, despite the artillery preparation. And, of course, they were helped by the speed with which Czech troops surrendered. Quote, they surrendered with alacrity. The Austrians were still quickly in full retreat. And the attack had been on a broad front, using all of his armies simultaneously. So Brusilov had no strategic reserve. You know, you usually save a pile of troops to exploit your breakthrough. Well, this is contrary to conventional doctrine. So, of course, it succeeded brilliantly. And within 3 weeks, the Russians took 250,000 prisoners. General Everett was still unwilling to attack. On June 9th, Brusilov found out that Everett's offensive had been postponed to the 18th. Apparently, Everett saw Brusilov's operation as, you know, a mere diversion before his own major attack. And Taylor says that Everett was jealous of Brusilov. These are all possible.
So this is pure, but so don't they have a commander that can order Everett to?
Yep, Alexeyev.
And what's he doing?
He's saying, Everett, attack. So on the 18th, Everett made a minor, ill-prepared, and completely ineffectual attack far south of where he was supposed to strike.
Shouldn't Everett have been shot or something?
Court connections.
Oh my God.
Yeah, friends in high places. So Alexeyev now had to switch gears, and he chose to do exactly what Brusilov had opposed from the very beginning. Instead of opening new battles on multiple fronts, they decided to take men from Evert and send them to Brusilov as reinforcements to exploit his success. So, just as Brusilov had predicted, the Germans saw Russian troop movements. You've got guys flowing south. So after an ineffectual attack and troops leaving the Central Front, they felt safe enough to transfer their own troops southwards. And with better railways, they got there first. Conrad had reduced the scale of his Italian operation and started sending reliable troops back to Galicia. So the Austrians are getting reinforcements. The Germans are coming in to help them. Brusilov's progress began to slow down. His men were encountering more and more Germans. And by August the 10th, his offensive was over. The Austrians had lost a huge chunk of territory, 200,000 killed or wounded, and 400,000 prisoners. I think the scale of that is pretty significant. German losses were somewhere around 150,000. Some sources say a little higher. And the Russians took over 500,000 casualties. Now, the Brusilov offensive was a success because the Germans transferred something like 35 divisions from the West Front to the Eastern Front. And the Verdun operation was called off. The Austrians weren't able to exploit their victory against the Italians because they had to rush troops east. So the Russians also saved Italy. But it's so tantalizing. What if Evert had carried out the main attack as planned? What if Ludendorff could not have reinforced the Austrians? Or if Kuropatkin had joined in the north as well? Ludendorff had 2 million men. Evert had 2 million men standing still, doing nothing. It was a major opportunity lost. And Brusilov wasn't the only one who thought that he might have knocked Austria-Hungary out of the war completely. And with that southern flank exposed, could Germany have kept fighting? You know, they would have had to now stretch their front to protect themselves along the borders of Hungary, Austria. The war might have ended in 1916.
No Russian Revolution.
No
Nazis, maybe.
I mean, you can speculate pretty. Alan Clark says the Allies couldn't win the war in the West, although they could lose it there. And he says they came close three times. The Schlieffen Offensive in 1914, certainly the disasters of 1916, they almost collapsed. And they were almost to lose it again in 1918. But the Germans recognized the great danger of the Eastern Front. They were vulnerable there. So even if Brusilov didn't win the war, he might have stopped Britain and France from losing it. And the unfortunate irony was that he couldn't save Russia. It was their last gamble, the last grand gesture of the Imperial Russian Army. And a little note from Taylor, Brusilov never forgave the failure of the Tsar Russian headquarters.
Oh, you did, I looked up what Brusilov went on to do when you started talking about him.
So where did he end up?
He ended up in the Red Army.
2 years later, he was happily serving under Trotsky.
There's an open letter from him and Lenin and Trotsky and a bunch of others imploring former Russian officers or former Tsarist officers to join the Red Army.
And how big is that? That a guy with Brusilov's prestige now calling on soldiers and officers. I think that's pretty pretty important.
But you know what you're I don't know if it's the bias of your sources or, you know, but just following what you're telling me as you're telling me it, it does seem like beyond technology and, the nature of war and the transformation and the size and scale of the armies, a lot of men are dying because of incompetent command.
Yep.
It just seems like British, French and Russian commanders, I'm Germans too, but we're just looking at it from the Allies' perspective. It just seems like these are immensely costly decisions that are being made and errors, blunders that are mm-hmm. killing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people.
Yep. Well, we're talking about countries that are monarchies.
Yeah.
Some constitutional, some not. They operate with a court and with court favorites. And when you have promotion by seniority or popularity, Britain has promotion by seniority. And Haig was a friend of the king. That weighed in pretty heavily. We will see some generals, Brusilov, one of them, but we will see some generals who have a little more tactical acumen, who are actually learning from these disasters. I mean, it took an awful lot of disasters for them to learn. But there were some changes in 1917 and 18 on how the war was fought that had they had some major repercussions. Before we get there, though, we have one more tragic, agonizing story to cover. That's Romania. Both sides had been courting Romania, where public opinion was largely divided. King Carol, who was originally German, had died in 1914. The new king is Ferdinand, and you know, by the name, he's also ethnic German. Ferdinand and his prime minister, Ion Bratianu, postponed a decision. Smart. The Russian ambassador was pressing them to join the Allies, or the Entente powers, and so was Rear Admiral Veselkin, commander of the Russian Danubian flotilla. This was a collection of riverboat steamships and gunboats. The idea had been to send help to Serbia along the Danube, but you know, the Austrians controlled both sides of the Danube, and the Serbians, as we saw, retreated to Albania and to evacuation. So with that option gone, Veselkin had nothing to do with his time but join into the intrigues. So Bucharest had a lot of secret negotiations and people meeting. Meanwhile, the Germans were bribing railway employees to turn a blind eye to shipments of arms and supplies headed for Bulgaria and for Turkey. Some Russian observers warned that Romania was unprepared for war, and that if they did come in, they would inevitably end up asking for Russian help. But it was hard for some people to understand that a neutral Romania could be more advantageous than an allied Romania. Shades of Italy, right? Russia had a new foreign minister. Sazonov was out, thanks to Rasputin and the Tsarina, Alexandra. The new minister was Boris Stürmer, serving simultaneously as prime minister, minister of the interior, and foreign minister. And he wanted action. So in July of 1916, he presented Romania with an ultimatum. In the immortal words, to paraphrase George Bush, you're with us or you're against us. So at that moment, the Brusilov offensive was doing well. So on August 17th, Romania gave in and signed the military alliance pressed on them. In the history of terrible timing, this has to be way up on the list. By August 17th, the Brusilov offensive was sputtering out. It was effectively over. And the Allies were hoping that Romania would act as some kind of counterweight to Bulgaria, or could even join up with the Allied force at Salonika. But Romania had already gained all the Bulgarian territory that they wanted in the Second Balkan War. They had their eye on the Austro-Hungarian province of Transylvania, with millions of ethnic Romanians living there. So on August 27th, the Romanian army struck north. and I quote, to the consternation of friends and enemies alike. The Romanians had 500,000 men in their army, and at first they just swept everything ahead of them. So remember, the Austrians were still reeling from Brusilov's attack. The Germans took some risks. They stripped troops from quiet sectors of other France, And they found a capable general, Falkenhayn. He had just been replaced as chief of staff by Hindenburg. So they gave him an army and said, you know, go attack Romania. So he attacked in Transylvania, while another general, von Mackensen, came through Bulgaria. And it quickly became clear that the Romanian army was even worse trained and worse equipped than the most pessimistic observers had claimed. The Romanians immediately called for Russian help, and it was Russian troops who slowed the German advance. But Constanta, the Romanian Black Sea port, fell in October. Bucharest was captured in December, and the Romanian army was finished. The small area of their country that they still held was defended by Russian soldiers.
This is the same thing that happened to Serbia almost, right? Like we kind of covered how.
Yeah, and it's very much like Italy coming into the war. The Russian front now extended to the Black Sea.
I mean, it's so different the way the great powers fare in these wars compared to these smaller powers. A smaller power, these smaller countries, they can just get taken out of the war entirely.
And yep.
And yep. The great powers can't. I mean. I guess they can. I guess we're about to see that they can. But only when they do it to themselves.
Yeah. Odd, eh? Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. So for the Russians, this is a disaster because their front has been extended by a quarter. Instead of three fronts, they're going to have four. This is going to tie up a quarter of their effort, of their troops. But Romania's declaration of war did benefit one country, Germany.
Their enemy.
Yeah, they were able to occupy Romanian wheatlands and get the food and the oil fields. And they now had better communications with their allies, Bulgaria and Turkey. So thank you, Romania, for helping us out. One historian, Westwood, also says that, whether rightly or wrongly, Germany had feared that other neutral countries might have been tempted to join the Entente. He names Denmark and the Netherlands as possibilities. Now, I've never heard anything about those two countries thinking of attacking Germany, right?
Yeah, so I wouldn't recommend it.
No. But maybe the Germans feared it, even if it's not real. But the fate of Romania erased those fears. And if Denmark or the Netherlands were thinking of it, I'm sure what happened to Romania would be enough to convince them to stay neutral.
Yeah.
During the war, I got to say half a war, the Romanians mobilized 800,000 men. They had 335,000 killed, 120,000 wounded, 80,000 prisoners or missing. Total losses, 71.4%. If you joined the Romanian army in World War I, your odds were 70% of getting killed, wounded, or captured.
I mean, it's practically 50% chance of getting killed.
Yeah. Yeah, but
it's a lot worse than just Russian roulette, like with one bullet.
Yeah, it is worse, right? By far. It's the fourth highest percentage of loss. The only countries who managed to surpass that were Russia, France, and Austria-Hungary. So Romania entering the war was really bad news for the Russians, but obviously it was a disaster for Romania. They tried to save what was left of their country by making peace with Germany in May of 1918. And then once they saw the new direction that the war was taking, they rejoined the Allies on November 10th, 1918. If you know any history, that's the day before the war ended. Oh, boy.
That's an agony and slaughter, indeed. Nobody was spared, really.
No. And as a lot of these guys, the historians, are saying, it's now a war of endurance. It's a boxing match with exhausted fighters who are still throwing punches, maybe hoping for that miraculous knockout. But
and less, we're past the halfway point, right? I mean, there's less of a war in ahead than behind.
No, it's going to take something pretty major to break the deadlock, and they got it.
So, did you want to talk about?
Just a reminder: if you are teaching World War One, or if you're a fan of it, beyond reading, photographs and film offer tremendous sources for this period. There's some really excellent war photography, and as we pointed out with the Hawthorne Ridge mine, there's even some film taken, and it's quite interesting to look at the original stuff and then compare it to movie coverage of the war. Yeah. There have been a number of films recently, right? 1917 and a remake of All Quiet on the Western Front and so on.